An Open Letter to Michelle Bachmann.
Representative Bachmann, in 2006, you attended a hearing on an anti-bullying bill and told state lawmakers, "There have always been bullies. Always have been, always will be. I just don't know how we're ever going to get to a point of zero tolerance. What will be our definition of bullying? Will it get to the point where we are completely stifling free speech and expression? What form of behavior will there be? Will we be expecting boys to be girls?" In 2008, Anoka Hennepin Schools, part of your congressional district, officially adopted a policy of neutrality around issues of sexual orientation. Students who identified as gay or lesbian or anything outside of the boxes we've built for them would have nowhere to go for resources or support or answers to their questions. The school district built a trap, whether out of malice or good intentions or simple ignorance, it does not matter which. In the past 2 years, 9 students in the Anoka Hennepin School District have killed themselves. More have tried. As a political philosophy or as a moral position, this is what neutral gets you. A 7th grader lying down in the bathtub, putting a hunting rifle in her mouth and pulling the trigger. A sophomore in high school hanging himself in the bedroom after a classmate said he was going to hell. Another girl trying to kill herself because she was so overwhelmed by the number of her friends trying to kill themselves. And of course, this isn't just about you, Representative Bachmann. You are not on the school board. You are a Statue of Liberty-shaped boogie monster that progressive parents scare their children with, all teeth and American flag pins. No, this is for the thousands of people who support you. For the millions more who either quietly approve or quietly disapprove, because in the end, that's the same thing. This is for the school officials who say that while at least 2 of the students were known to have been gay, they found no evidence that bullying was a factor in any of the suicides. For those who still think that God would rather see a teenager dead than in love with someone of the same gender. For the parents who dismiss gay-straight alliances as gay sex clubs. For anyone who can see a child on fire and look the other way to keep the ash out of their eyes. When we talk about rights, we're not just talking about the right to get married or the right to not be discriminated against when applying for jobs. We are talking about the right to exist as a human being with dignity and safety and freedom. These are rights that must be fought for, rights that can only be won through active, intentional struggle. If you are neutral, you are neutral in the same way that a bullet is neutral. You are a razor blade, a length of rope. If you are silent, you are complicit. And you, Representative Bachmann, patron saint of sleeping pills, the voice and champion of bullies everywhere, judge, jury, and executioner, when you get to hell, take solace in the fact that your path there was both narrow and straight.
This is J.D. Doyle starting part 3 of my Salute to Spoken Word with a justifiably angry piece by an artist going just by Guante, which he called Neutral, an Open Letter to Michelle Bachmann. If you've been paying attention to my first 2 segments, you know there's a lot of anger in this genre. Here's a set of 4 pieces to further my point, starting with Corey E. Houlihan and What If.
What if every time some idiot opened his feeble-minded mouth and said, "Shut up, fag," a hand from nowhere cocked back and fed him, hit him so hard he'd enter heaven and then leave? What if every time you said, "Yo, kid, that's so gay," I slit your throat from ear to ear and ruin your mama's day? Because see, that's what you do to us. That's how we live each day. That's how you view us attacking people because they're gay. And it comes in the slightest ways. It comes in whispers subtle. But my eardrums absorb every word you utter. You say it with a smile, a realization of dismay, and follow up with some lame ass, "Yo, I'm just kidding. My best friend's cousin's husband's sister's dad is gay." But what if I quit tolerating your ignorant, hateful views on these 29 years of anger and took it all out on you? What if I moved a nation of dykes and fags and queers? For every attack or call to arms, we bash the bashers back. What if, What if I ate my Wheaties and worked out every day and started bashing people that I didn't think were gay? What if I bashed your family? What could you even do? You'd sit around and hate me like I'm beginning to hate you. And this hatred runs real deep, breeds toxic fear, and mine's born weak. But I'm tired of watching my back. I think it's time that you watch yours. So this is an overdue message to gay bashers and closet doors. I am not some abomination. I am not less than you. So you better lock your doors at night, 'cause I'm beginning to move through. I've tried to explain it. I've tried to make you see that I am you and you are me. We just love differently, but you didn't want to hear it. You didn't really care. So now I'll have to show you how it feels to be real scared, to wonder if it'll happen, and when and how and why, and who will tell your parents, and how long will they cry? Will they stand at your funeral, mourning in silent prayer? Suddenly there's protesters and the cameras are there, saying they never should have had you. You never should have been born. They'll hold quotes up from their Bible, saying you were wrong, that you got what was coming, and you brought it on yourself, man. I gotta bring this poem back down. Anger's not good for my health. But what I'm really saying, what I'm trying to do, is stop all this nonsense that you're putting children through. 1 in 3 statistics say are a suicide of a child born gay. Their blood is on your hands now. Be responsible for what you say. Be responsible for what you do. 'Cause even if they killed themselves, it was you that killed them too.
I want a one-breasted president. Someone who lives in a high-risk category with nothing to lose. Someone not tied to a political party, a union, a corporation. A one-breasted president. Someone not tied to American corporate faith-based charities, American corporate money. I want a one-breasted warrior. I want her to tell us what to do with our oceans, our forests, our bodies. I'd like to hear her definition of mass destruction. A one-breasted warrior who would build a house that's not so white. A house built on bedrock. Not the cigarette butts and shotgun shells of the NRA, the FDA. I want her to stand up and say, Mr. Speaker, I will not be another statistic. I will not be put into a box marked some parts not included. Assembly is required. I want a menopausal pope. Someone who has bled and created life. I'd like to hear her thoughts on contraception, masturbation, Americanization, globalization, populations dying while we eat genetically engineered food, drink chemically treated water, and buy enough insurance to cover the medical bills I want. Do you know what I had? I had a one-breasted mother. One breast. No uterus, and a yellow bloated liver, she was the incredible shrinking woman. Shrinking under her Bible, her husband, her mother, I needed her to wear her scars and go bald in public, not tied to a Bible, a husband, a mother who all silently agreed not to talk about it. He voted for Reagan while she baked cookies. You know, she never talked about it. She never talked about being sick. I wonder if she talked to God. She talked about God. She prayed. She prayed for people, over people. She went to prayer groups. But I wonder if she talked to her God, because she sure didn't talk to me. Now, it's 20 years later, and I'm living in a high-risk category with a president who lost, in a nation shrinking under its Bible, its media, its money, its emissions, its omissions, its admissions, its backrooms, its boardrooms, its payoffs, its police stations, its courtrooms, its blow it up, throw it away, suck it dry politics. And what if one day, God, it could be right now. One tiny cell somewhere around my Texas, my Missouri or Illinois, yes, to the south or the west, decides to turn against me. And that little bastard cell starts dividing and multiplying, multiplying and dividing, growing and growing until they wheel me down that long hall, carve out my mountains, strip mine my fertile valleys, pump my streams full of toxic chemicals until my hair falls out and my skin turns yellow, until I don't want to live in this country. Inhabit this planet, this body, anymore. And I wonder, will I stand up? Open my mouth? Or shrink under my fear?
So I was on this bus, and there's this guy who's sitting kind of kitty-cornered in back of me, and I saw that he had his dick hanging out of his pants. And, like, there was this girl sitting next to him, but she was asleep, and I didn't know what to do. So I kind of slyly caught his eye, and then I stood up and yelled really loud, "Excuse me, sir, could you please put your dick back in your pants?" And then he did. And then I was afraid that he was going to attack me right after we got to the bus station, but instead he just disappeared, and I never saw him again. Baba da baba baba da baba baba da baba da baba dang a dang dang a ding a dong ding I do I do I do dip da dip da dip do I do I do dip da dip da dip baba da baba baba da baba baba da baba da baba dang a dang dang a ding a dong ding I do. But the motherfuckers say we can't, 'cause you're a girl and I'm a girl, or at least something close to the most we can hope for is the nuns of a union in Vermont, and I want church bells. I want rosary beads. I want Jesus on his knees. I want to walk down the aisle and the patriarchy smile. That's not true. But I do want to spend my life with you. And I want to know 50 years from now, when you're in a hospital room getting ready to die, when visiting hours of a family member's only, I want to know to let me in, to say goodbye. Because I've been 50 years memorizing the way the lines beneath your eyes form rivers when you cry, and I've held my hand like an ocean at your cheek saying, baby, flow to me. Because 50 years I've watched you grow with me. 50 years of you never letting go of me through nightmares and dreams and everything in between, from the day I said, buy me a ring. Buy me a ring that will turn my finger green so I can imagine our love is a forest. I want to get lost in you. And I swear I grew like a wildflower every hour of the 50 years I was with you. And that's not to say we didn't have bad days. Like the day you said that checkout clerk was so sweet. And I said, I'd like to eat that checkout clerk. And you said, honey, that's not funny. And I said, baby, maybe you could take a fucking joke every now and then. So I slept on the couch that night. But when morning came, you were laughing. Yeah, there were times we were both half in and half out the door, but I never needed more than the stars on your grin to lead me home. For 50 years, you were my favorite poem. And I'd read you every night, knowing I might never understand every word, but that was okay, because the lines of you were the closest thing to holy I'd ever heard. You'd say, this kind of love has to be a verb. We have paint on a slick canvas. It's going to take a whole lot to stick, but if we do, we'll be a masterpiece, and we were. From the beginning, living in towns that frowned at our hand-holding, folding their stares like hate notes into our pockets so we could pretend they weren't there. You said fear is only a verb if you let it be. Don't you dare let go of my hand. That was my favorite line. That and the time when we saw two boys kissing on the street in Kansas, and we both broke down crying because it was Kansas, and what are the chances of seeing anything but corn in Kansas? We were born again that day. I cut your cord and you cut mine, and the chords of time played like a concerto of hope. Like we could feel the rope unwind, the noose of hate loosening. Loosening from years of people like you aren't welcome here. People like you cannot work here. People like you cannot adopt. So we had lots of cats and dogs, and once even a couple of monkeys you taught to sing, hey, hey, we're the monkeys. You were crazy like that. And I was so crazy about you, and nights you couldn't sleep, I'd lay awake for hours counting sheep for you, and you would rewrite the rhythm of my heartbeat with the way you held me in the morning, resting your head on my chest. I swear my breath turned silver the day your hair did, like I swore marigolds grew in the folds of my eyelids the first time I saw you, and they bloomed the first time I watched you dance to the tune of our kitchen kettle in our living room. In a world that could have left us hard as metal, we were soft as nostalgia together. For 50 years we feathered wings too wide to be prey, and we flew through days strong and days as fragile as sandcastles at high tide. You would fold your love into an origami firefly and throw it through my passageways till all my hidden chambers were lit with lanterns. Now every trap door of every pore my heart is open because of you, because of us. So I do want to be in that room with you. When visiting hours of a family member's only, I want to know to let me in. I want to know to let me hold you while I sing. Baba da baba baba da baba baba da baba da baba dang a dang dang ding a dong ding. I'm so in love with you, baby. I'm so in love with you. Dip da dip da dip baba da baba baba da baba baba da baba da baba dang a dang dang. Dingy dong ding, goodbye.
For the second part of that set, an artist calling herself Jen Ed brought us One Breasted President from her 2005 album Exposed. And then there was a very short piece by Sarah D called Sarah Rides the Greyhound. That's from a very rare 1995 album named Free to Fight, which was kind of a unique project. Its aim was to teach women self-defense and empowerment, and in addition to the vinyl record of music and voice tracks, it also included a 75-page booklet showing self-defense techniques, done in punk zine style. Closing the set was Andrea Gibson and I Do, from her 2006 CD, When the Bough Breaks. I've got a couple pieces that involve one of our first gay playwrights, Robert Patrick. He was a pioneer of off-off-Broadway and the gay theater movement in the 1960s. His first play, The Haunted Host, premiered at the Café Chino in New York City in 1964. From a recording from last year, here he is talking about discovering that theater.
50 years ago today, I wandered into the Café Chino. I remember the date because it was my niece Joni's birthday. I was in New York for one day en route from Summerstock in Kennebunkport, Maine, to a dishwashing job in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Friends driving from Kennebunkport drove me as far as New York so I might stop and see a college friend who now lived there. He was not home, so I asked his landlady where Greenwich Village was, where the artists are, and she directed me to a subway. It let me out at 7th Avenue and 14th Street. I followed a Salvation Army band downtown to Sheridan Square, where I turned left to explore West 4th Street, which looked very villagey. On West 4th Street, I saw a beautiful boy named John P. Dodd and followed him around a corner to an obscure little one-block-long side street called Cornelia Street. He entered a storefront labeled the Café Chino. I followed him, and as far as I'm concerned, I have never left. The first people I saw in the Café Chino were directors Neil Flanagan and Andy Milligan, dressed in red and white striped jackets and straw hats, rehearsing a scene from The Importance of Being Earnest. I took a job at 12th Street and 5th Avenue at Macmillan Publishers, so I had but to cross Washington Square and walk a couple of blocks to get to the Chino right after work, where I would mop or shop or do whatever was needed just to be allowed to stay there. You see, I came from a place where intelligence, sensitivity, and honesty were forbidden. If you said anything intelligent, sensitive, or honest, you were in some way punished for it. At the Chino, intelligence, sensitivity, and honesty were welcome, almost demanded. It was the first place where I felt any promise of having the kind of friends I had seen people have in movies like All About Eve or The Red Shoes. People of talent, courage, vision, a broader vision than merely their own personal concerns. People who, with wit, people who could banter and wisecrack. I must tell you something of the state of theater among the other arts at that time in 1961. The other arts, starting with painting, had entered the modern era in the middle of the 19th century. The realists in literature in Paris and the impressionists in painting came up with a new credo. They felt they must write or paint in certain ways, even if no one bought it. This quickly infected the other arts, and we entered the modern era. Theater did not enter this era because it cost money to do theater. You need space, time, you must support a lot of people, you must pay for productions. What happened at the Chino that allowed theater to enter the modern era was people did it for free. They did theater at the Chino and at the other original off-Broadway theaters for free. They did them in places which made their living other ways, coffee houses, galleries, churches, bookstores, bars. So there was a tremendous explosion of suppressed theatrical creativity. The changes in subject matter, style, content, and form that were made at the Chino have since infected not only theater, but all the performing arts. Those who remember what the performing arts were like in 1961 can see the influence of the Chino and its many, many children. In every stage play, movie, TV show, rock concert, dance, opera. I loved Joe Chino, and I loved what he made happen at the Cafe Chino, and I loved the people that he made it happen for. I deeply regret the loss of many of those friends. I don't regret the time I spent with them or anything which people say one might have given up in order to be there and stay there. As I am quoted as saying, yes, I live in the past, and if you had my past, so would you.
I mentioned that Robert Patrick's first play was The Haunted Host in 1964. His plays got a lot of productions, and that one was done again in 1974, and that cast featured one of our gay treasures, Harvey Fierstein, in his first legitimate theater role. When Fierstein released an album in 1995 called This Is Not Going to Be Pretty, he paid a bit of homage to Robert Patrick by including a piece by him called Poof Positive. It's a long piece, about 13 minutes, but well worth my devoting that time to it in this show. And you'll quickly realize the subject was AIDS.
Hello. If you're calling to tell me that you've got it too, save both our breaths. Just say ditto and leave me to my beads. Oh, Bob! Bob, darling, of course you haven't got it. Who'd give it to you? Except for a good-natured USO girl like me. And we were way back in the 60s when the word AIDS was preceded by the term American military. How am I? Well, when I think of what I've got, I feel like shit. When I think of how I got it, I can't complain. How are you? Oh, yes, darling, I know you called. Oh, I despise those episodes of Twilight Zone where people install phones in their coffins, so I haven't been answering mine. This exception is not because I still love you, but because I want someone literate listening in case I croak while Mom and Sis are out at morning mass. Oh, yes, they're here to identify the body, which millions could do in the dark. And you pray for the soul, the mind being unknown to them. You, I presume, have called to glean piquant detail of what it's like to die as I have lived. A socio-sexuological statistic. Oh, I know you writers. Your life's hungry little creatures. Well, here's a fairly poignant paradox for your next play. I came home from a rally for gay rights, only to discover I had the gay wrong. No, wait, that's not a paradox. It's an irony. It's an irony, one of life's little ironies, like Anita Bryant turning out to be right. Oh, darling, don't bother answering back. Anything said to me now may as well be written on decomposing squash. The brain's the first thing to go, you know. All except for the parts dedicated to pain, which are apparently immune. Do I need anything? Oh, how droll. Wait, I might just have enough comeback for that one. No, I don't need anything. I've already got cancer, pneumonia, and mother at my side. All the things that make life worth leaving. How's that? Come over. Oh, don't be ridiculous. I'm retaining more water than Shelley Winters in the Poseidon Adventure. No, I want you to remember me as the Botticelli flower child I was. Oh, God, I was the prettiest queen that ever paraded for peace, and now I'm something that has to be burned after death. Oh, I was pretty, wasn't I? Hello? Bob? All right, smartass, you can answer that one, but think before you speak. Ah, saved by the cliche. No, that's the church across the way. One toll means it's 7:30. At 8 o'clock, it's a David O. Selznick production up here. And Mom and Sis will come crawling back on their knees, muttering rosaries. So I'm yours until 8 or till the end of time, whichever comes first. Oh, what is that couplet by old A.E. Housman? And he shall hear the stroke of 8, but not the stroke of 9, about the condemned man in his cell. Ha! Condemned for not being condemned. The wit and wisdom of the living dead. Oh, you like that? I leave it to you. You want anything else? Records, tapes, the history of Western music from Mahalia to Michael Jackson? Oh, I want to give it all away before some fool plays disco at my funeral. And the record gets stuck, and of course no one can tell, and it goes on and on and on. Oh, but I'm being negative. You want to hear some positive funeral plans? I want to be freeze-dried, cut in half, and made into ballerina plaques. No, actually, I'm going to be cremated. Yeah, it's my last chance to get my ashes hauled. Please forgive the low level of repartee on this end, but I haven't been reading anything but condolence cards. No, I'm not going back into the hospital. I abhor the term legally alive. Oh, God! Think of the great men who have nibbled on me. Now I'm naught but a picnic for a virus, something that can't even decide if it's a plant or an animal. Take it from me, it's no picnic being one. No, Bob, there's nothing medical science can do for me. AIDS is the gift that keeps on giving. Actually, my luck, when I first got sick, I had this sweet little Indian doctor. He kept folding and unfolding his glasses like a Rubik's Cube. He asked if I'd mind if he took samples of my blood and urine and saliva and stool. So I said, why, no, Doc, but then can we do what I like? Oh, and I even used one of your lines on the poor fool. Well, he told me that there'd be much less chance of my having gotten it if I'd been what they call a top man. I couldn't resist. I said, why, Doc, I've always been a top man. You can get it further up you that way. Oh, when the diagnosis came back, bingo. He told me to watch out for the depression that often accompanies a diagnosis of AIDS. So I said with a sigh of great relief, AIDS! Oh, thank God, Doc, I thought you said age. Well, you know my motto, brighten the little coroner where you are. I did try to make up by offering to be a guinea pig for any cute little tricks that medical science might want to try. But he said, oh, Mr. Wood, we cannot use you as an experimental animal. I said, Doc, I'm an effeminate queer. I've never been used as anything else. Except by you, Bob. Yes, we know that. Yes, Bob, we were truly in love. That was love, wasn't it? No wonder it went out of style. Oh, God, I used to be clever. When I was a little girl, back in East Bay, California, I realized that East Bay was Pig Latin for beast. But I knew I'd really found my niche when I realized that Alice Faye was Pig Latin for phallus. That is good, isn't it? Say, do you think we could interest the virus in 1940s musicals? It'll turn queer and stop reproducing. No, you've got to be born to royalty. Born to royalty. God, that's how that lovely old closet queen who brought me out used to put it, born to royalty. He used to spot some hunky number in the corner and he'd go, do you think he was born to royalty? Ah, God knows I was. 12 years old, I rummaged through the largest country western record barn in California and found the only Marlene Dietrich album on the West Coast. You have to be born with that instinct. And all by my lonesome, I discovered Walt Whitman and Aubrey Beardsley and dyeing my bangs with lemon juice and ordering all my clothes a size too small and outlining my eyes with ballpoint pen. So when the boys made me cry, they saw nothing running. When my age became the socially conscious we generation, I fought for my right to riot in pink high heels. And once we'd OD'd on politics in the me generation, I rode a lavender motorcycle to New York City after using my last sunshine acid tab to spike the communion wine. No, I didn't. But I should have. I could have been a contender. I could have been Jim Jones. But let's not talk about me when I'm gone. Where was I? Oh, yes, yes, yes. We're born that way. We're part of nature's plan, that rift. Well, it's trite but true. Where would this world be without its fairies?
Well, we may be about to find out, mayn't we?
And you! You've been too ugly for a decade for anyone to fuck with. You'll probably live to see it. A world without fairies. Bloomingdale's, of course, will have to close. There'll be no girl singers to speak of and speak of and speak of and speak of. Muscle shirts will be marked down to $2.99 in memoriam. Whole strains of ferns and poodles will die out. But of course, fairies have been dying out since the 1970s Marlboro Macho movement. Ah, If I live till noon, I will never understand. Clones trying to look like the very bullies that beat us up. They are living proof, wherever that still applies, that you do not have to learn to act gay. You have to learn to act straight, which may be the origin of the verb to ape. Why, if it hadn't been for effeminate holdouts like me, the color beige might have vanished off the face of the earth. Well, give yourself a gold star, you noticed. Yes, I'm wearing myself out. I am not having an experience I can't prolong. Do you remember those fantasies we used to have about attending our own funerals? Not as much fun as I thought they would be. Ha! It's my party and I'll die if I want to. Oh, I'm being cruel. What a way to go. Look. You're okay. I'm not okay, okay? Okay. I'm dying! Everybody dies except for two unconfirmed reports from Bethlehem and Transylvania. I don't know why it takes my generation by such surprise. What did they think? We were all just gonna go into reruns. I mean, wouldn't you think that a queen would be thrilled to know she's finally about to lose all that fat forever? Must one go through the official five stages? Oh, what are they? Anger, depression, denial, bargaining, and acceptance. Back up, because here comes my acceptance speech. I am now, and have always been, a flaming faggot, responsible for style in its every manifestation. And I've got my own five stages. Flippancy, sentimentality, sarcasm, camp, and smut. They got me through life, and deedy damn it, they'll see me through death. Now shut up before I stop loving you. Oh, are you crying? How's this for comfort? We were probably the last two white people to fall in love. And there are no challenges on the horizon, but how could anyone fall into something as awful as love when they're being safe? No, of course you're right, you're always right. No. Love will survive. They couldn't kill it with purple hairdos, they can't kill it with a plague. Boys will fall in love with each other's earlobes, if that's all that's left. Because it never really was about sex, was it? It was about love. Yes, I know you did. Yes, I know you do. Oh, God, I'm suffering like a living thing. Sex may be safe. Love never is. Ah, saved from a fate worse than... Why, let me look. Yes, there's Mom and Sis rushing from judgment. No, I can see the church and the sky, the old International Stud Bar. No, it's a restaurant now like everything else. God, how'd they ever clean that back room? Probably poured polyurethane to level out the ruts left by my knees. No, I don't want you to call again. Listen, try that new phone sex line. They guarantee troll-free calls. Well, if you have to do something, write me a funny AIDS play. Oh, sure you can. Biggest joke played on us since sex itself. And with a longer punchline. No, I don't want you to call again. Listen, if God had meant us to be friends with our ex-lovers, he wouldn't have made them such creeps. Goodbye. I love you.
The AIDS guy. The AIDS guy doesn't want to play pool because the nurse cheats. So he wins. He'll feel better, she thinks, as if anything could make him feel better. The rib sandwich, the blood on the lapel of strangers, as if anyone could know what it is like. As the medication burns into his lungs and the room spins, and he collapses backwards onto his berth. The ship drowns under the full moon, curses, sirens entice the wasted. Passion burns, only in fantasy. The young man leans against the pale wall flesh, under an angel's cap and nothing else. Just a coat of saliva and cum over his half-hard cock. Shark eyes stare into nowhere in the blue dawn. Punch drunk. Metals and heaving hospices. Broken hulls that sink unnoticed, like pills down the white throat into despair. Crossed, the crooked heart hangs where memory, a bucket of scars and old leashes walk. Masters stalk through shingled corridors on his back, shivering cracks that go nowhere and never were. So we are before we were. He was, he is, he isn't. No, no name. Undressed, a smile. To urge, a rest. To give a gun, a pill, a wrench, the wreck. The boil burst in thirst, the rabbi screams. The Christ a go-go in cheap. Ceremonies, they tumble quickly into the spirit. We are, we were. And the nurse does her best. But it is the other side, the hearts of gold in machines that breed, undress the wound, open the sky like smoke, torn into life, inevitable dissipation, mutiny, lingering fingers, lingering tongue, that no one understands, from love to this, AZT. The bitterest pill, a poison to take, to save an afternoon lying with the ones I love, I love, I love. The bundled hero approaches the room with an axe and a script. He kisses the dying and turns on the TV, saying you have to watch this movie. I don't know. I don't know. I'd die again to be with you. I'd kill myself to be with you. The way you smile, the love you give.
I met Julian Andes, 19, in line to buy tickets for the Yes concert at the Forum. I saw him again 2 days later in line to buy tickets for the Lou Reed concert at the Santa Monica Civic. We talked, had lunch at a Denny's coffee shop, and drove to his apartment. Inside, after 3 beers, he pointed toward his bedroom. Do you want to go in there? He said. Yeah, okay, I said. I met Craig Steinman, 14, on the Pili Beach on the island of Maui, Hawaii. We started hanging out together and taking acid. One afternoon we were at his house when he got a letter from a girl he was in love with who had moved to Oregon. He started looking at me strangely and said, Dennis, hug me like you hug your girlfriends. I said, forget it. He said, I'm going to sit on your lap. I didn't say anything, so he did, felt my heart on underneath, closed his eyes and kissed me. I met Robert Douglas, 18, at Arcadia High School in gym class. We were both reading David Harris's Goliath. I became obsessed with him, and we grew to be close friends. 2 years later, in his bedroom in Monterey Park, he asked me if I was in love with him. I said, Yeah. No surprise, right? He said, no. So I said, and? He said, come here. I met David Sellers, 15, through my friend Julian Andes. We three drank a bottle of Jack Daniels beside his parents' pool. We were laughing when David suddenly leered at me and walked off a short distance. Julian said, go on and take him if you want him. I followed David out and stood beside him looking at the rose garden. I put my hand on his shoulder. He smiled at me and said, bullseye. I met Kevin Creedon, 19, in a hustler bar on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. He went back in a cab with me to my hotel. He closed the curtains and sat down on the bed. I said, well, what do you like to do? He said, oh, I don't know. I like to fuck about once a year. I said, well, let's play it by ear. He lay back on the bed and laughed. I met Frederick Blaine, 21, through an ad in the Advocate newspaper. He came to my house in Monrovia one evening and we watched television. He said he had to be back at his parents' house by 11 p.m. It was 9:15. I said, well, I guess we should get busy then. He said, I've never had sex before, I'm afraid. And I said, don't worry about it. He put his arms around my waist and lay his head on my shoulder like we were slow dancing. I met Joe Hardy, 15, in a glitter rock club on the Sunset Strip in 1974. We talked about music, first there, then in his bedroom. We knelt on the floor smoking grass and looking through pictures of him as a child. You were always a knockout, I said. He looked surprised. Are you gay? He said. I nodded. What a coincidence, he said. After a few moments of grinning at one another, I leaned over and kissed him. Take that, I said. I met John, ? On Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood when a friend and I decided to split the cost of a hustler. We drove him back to my friend's apartment on the Sunset Strip. We smoked two joints and, it being my turn first.
I followed Harvey Fierstein with two somber pieces. By Ian Stevens was the piece The AIDS Guy from his 1993 CD Whining, Dining, Drilling. And then kind of an experimental piece called Them, which included spoken word, dance, and instrumentation by the artists Dennis Cooper, who was the narrator, Chris Cochran, and Ishmael Houston Jones, from 2011. Okay, I think I need to change the mood a bit. So by Donald Curry, here's a slice of life from his 2002 audiobook, Sex and Mayhem.
My first lover went mad. The second went
straight.
The third guy turned into a Christian fundamentalist. The fourth took to drink, and the fifth became a woman. I obviously have a devastating effect on men. This is my story. Most of it true. It's a tawdry tale, but whose isn't? We all start our adult lives with the voracious self-importance of an Ayn Rand wannabe. By middle age, it's morphing into Mamet, and one morning you wake up and look in the mirror and think, oh shit,
It's Samuel Beckett.
Dude, it's tragic. But at least the literary quality improves. And as a dear friend, now unfortunately deceased, once said to me, girlfriend, think of all the millions of people who've lived anonymous lives and died without a trace. Just like us. So here's my trace. A tale of love, sacred and profane, unrequited and consummated, black and blue. It begins on an autumn afternoon in the city of San Francisco, the city where I was born and where much of this tale unfolds.
Imagine a gay boy born in the Lavender Bermuda Triangle, raised pre-gay liberation, coming out just before the Great Awakening, and being a rather prettily handsome young man when the shit hit the fan, carousing to beat the band like any damn skanky hoe all through the 60s and 70s, blasted into stunned silence by grief and grisly death as the century ground to its horrific halt, and still alive now to tell the tale.
I guess I have a responsibility to do just that, since so many others didn't make it to this shore. So my tale, as I was saying, begins on an autumn afternoon in the year 1964, on my first day of college. My mother, much to my humiliation, had insisted on not only driving me to school on this first day of my adult life, but on picking out my wardrobe. A polyester horror of ankle-length pants, ankle-high mucklucks, imitation Pendleton shirt buttoned up tight, the whole fashion blunder topped off with thick-rimmed glasses and slicked-down hair. The campus was unfortunately only 10 minutes away from my parents' house where I still lived. If I'd had any sense at all, I would have gone away to college, ideally to the other end of the continent. But through a combination of apathy and fear, I opted for the easy way out. So there I sat in the passenger seat of her little red Volkswagen, hunched over and sullen, with that perfectly hideous outfit on, feeling like a trapped rat and looking like a drowned one. I had to plead with her to please, please drop me a few blocks from school to maintain what little dignity I had left, and she rather peevishly pulled over to the curb and asked me when I'd like to be picked up. I mumbled something about calling her later and slammed the car door as hard as I could in the poor woman's face. I could feel her outraged and disapproving stare burning into my back as I skulked away, cursing under my breath, "Fuck you, you bitch," while silently screaming, a la Susan Hayward, "I want to live!" I didn't want to be Norman Bates in Psycho. I wanted to be Sal Mineo in Rebel Without a Cause, but without that nervy Natalie Wood getting in the way. So off I stomped, looking, as they'd say today, hella weird, and entered the main theater of the drama department for a day-long welcoming session. Picture it now. The theater full of young kids, fresh out of the box, drama queens no less, our brains dizzy with showbiz lyrics, bodies befuddled with hormone rushes, and our souls, bursting with the mad desire to express ourselves. We were ready for our close-up, Mr. DeMille. We wanted inspiration, anguish, terrible, glamorous torment, fabulous costumes, an Oscar and a standing ovation. But instead, on what should have been the precipice of a thrilling adventure, we were being lulled into lethargy by a parade of pompous professors, spewing banalities, until we were all squirming in a stupefying dither of disappointment and dismay. You could feel the air getting heavier and thicker with boredom, as one by one heads began nodding, and even the occasional snore could be heard beneath the gaseous drone emanating from the stage. I started surreptitiously checking around to see if there was anyone I might be able to somehow browbeat into throwing me onto the stage floor right there in front of the student body, God, and Professor Osgood, tearing my goddamn geeky polyester pants right off my skinny ass and fucking the hell out of me. Like the boy in the seat next to me, for instance. The love child of Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. And suddenly I was roused from my reverie.
when the air, subtly but distinctly, altered, as if the room itself gasped and held its breath. Professor Joseph Demillon had taken the stage, and I was instantly alert, attentive, and face to face with my destiny. He had Rasputin eyes, a hypnotic velvety voice, and the face of a Saturday afternoon second feature hero, a slightly noirish mix of Joseph Cotten, Gary Cooper, and Veronica Lake. He chain-smoked, ground his teeth, and expounded like an uncorked genie. He was brilliant. He was blonde. He was built. Bingo! Once I set eyes on him, I knew that someday we'd have our own steamy little sex palace, just big enough for two.
Let me indulge myself on the next piece, as it's by a friend of mine, Ray Hill. He has generally been known as the gay activist in Houston for the last several decades. This selection is from the radio show Wild and Stein from November of 1992, and Ray is reminiscing about gay and lesbian life in Houston in the 1950s and 60s.
I come to the gay and lesbian community from the experience that there was no community. There may have been some geography. There may have been some common meeting places, but there was, by no semblance, any concept of community. In the late 50s and the early 60s, gay people hated themselves and one another. I met the great floral designer Leonard Thorpe under four different names in maybe 5 years. Gay people didn't have last names. They were ashamed, they were frightened, they were intimidated. We had a phrase, drop a nickel on a sister, which meant call their boss and get them fired. When the show started in 1975, Houston did not have any semblance of gay and lesbian community as we know now. There had been an attempt in the late 60s, 68, 69, through the organization of Promethean Society to create an organization. But Rita and I, Rita Wanstrom, Papa Bear, this wonderful caricature of a magnificent person whom I've learned to love dearly and still love and respect, Rita and I tried to get gay homosexuals organized in self-defense to deal with, like, police problems and things of that nature. It was not about changing the laws or decriminalizing the felony sodomy statute. It was about getting the boot off their neck, kind of thing. But we didn't know how to do that, and those people were not ready for that. We'd hold a meeting and get 200 people, and how we'd hold a meeting is Rita would call the other women's bars, and the bars would make an announcement, there will be a meeting on a certain date at a certain time. And then we would leaflet the cars parked at the men's bars, a little flyer saying, giving the date and time and place of the meeting, and run them off on a mimeograph machine. And getting printing was impossible in the first place. You go to places that did printing with gay material, and they would just, you know, either quote you a price of $4,000 for $150 worth of printing or run you out. We even had auxiliary health care. If someone got brutally beaten, and that happened a lot because coming in town and rolling the queers was a common practice in the 50s and 60s, we kept sterile sheets and sterile surgical instruments at one of the bars, and we'd spread sheet over the pool table and bring them in and put their face back together. Because you didn't go to any of the hospitals, if you went to the public hospital, which is Jeff Davis at the time, you're subject to be charged with an offense yourself. And if you went to the other emergency room, and there were only two emergency rooms in town at the time, the other emergency room, of course, was St. Joseph's Hospital, and the nuns were not unopinionated as far as being gay is concerned. So it's very difficult to understand what life is like when there is no gay or lesbian community at all. None. Zero. Silch. Thank you.
a section entitled Witches and Fairies. The most important and frequently mentioned day to the fairies and the witches alike was Thursday. Geoffrey Burton Russell notes, the witches of Dauphine constituted a sect, and they assembled at Sabbath, usually on Thursdays. At the Sabbath, the witches danced, held sexual orgies, and frequently had intercourse with demons. Thursday was the day women all over Europe rode out on night to worship under the leadership of the greatest god of the witches, the Maid Diana, queen of the underworld of spirits, as well as supreme huntress and midwife on earth. As late as the 16th century in Italy, her followers went out on procession Thursday night to a meeting where they feasted and danced in her honor to ensure the fertility of their fields. They would also put out food and drink for wandering night spirits and would depart their bodies to journey in their souls, according to Russell. So I'd begin to understand the story underlining my high school taboo about wearing the color green on Thursday, the green-wearing fairy people and the Celtic wise women and wizards had used lesbian and gay sex rites in ceremonies held especially on Thursdays and had been punished, murdered, publicly terrorized for it. Ancestors of my high school contemporaries and sisters of mine had been those witches and witnesses to their fall from power. So the strange little warning phrase of never wearing green on Thursday, lest you be taken for one of them, creates a bond with them over the centuries. I asked about 500 people whether they knew of the taboo of wearing green on Thursday, about half of them remembering the prohibition from their high school years. A few people reported variations. In one Kansas town, wearing green and pink together, especially on Thursday, branded a person a queer. 60 miles away, the colors were green and yellow. From one Boston school, a woman told me the formula was the wearing of orange and yellow together on Thursday. In a small town in Idaho, the color was yellow. The students were of Welsh descent. The school mascot was a dragon, and they practiced the annual snake dance. In Midland, Texas, knots in tennis shoe laces gave a person away as being queer, with no reference to a day of the week. In another school, leaving a tag in the collar of a new shirt is the giveaway for boys. This tag, used for hanging up the shirt, is called a fruit loop. No doubt there are plenty of variations on these particular themes throughout the country, but the most common by far is green on Thursday. The children's subculture in my high school was remembering some crucial information concerning fairies and queers, witch hunts of the 13th and 14th centuries, and Thursday sexual rites of many centuries past. In effect, the students were warning each other away from behavior that had once been and could be again subject to hideous punishment, torture, seizure of property, and death by public execution. Gay behavior today is still at times punished by humiliation, ostracism, economic deprivation, beatings, murder, family hatred. A long legacy of the products of the Inquisition and other rigid social orders. The high school warnings reinforce at the precisely appropriate time the pressure the students felt to act in a rigidly heterosexual manner in order to take an approved place in the social order. Text by Judy Gron another mother tongue. Gay words, gay worlds. This is Mike Meesh.
That piece also comes from the archives of the radio show Wild and Stein, and the reading from a book by the poet Judy Gron was done in July 1985 by the show's co-producer Mike Meesh, who died of AIDS in 1987. His ashes were scattered in the backyard of KPFT. This is J.D. Doyle, and I thank you for joining me in this three-part show on spoken word in its various forms. I'm closing with two very different short tracks. The first is not intentionally humorous, but sounds that way now. It's from 1967, from a movie soundtrack called Teenage Rebellion. This particular track was narrated by Bert Topper and is called The Gay Teenager.
If loneliness drives some girls to prostitution, it drives some men in another direction. The history of homosexuality is as long as the history of man. From the glory that once was Greece to the decadence that destroyed Rome, homosexuality has been both despised and idolized. Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Frederick the Great, Leonardo da Vinci, and Michelangelo are but some of the names that any homosexual will point to as examples of virility and a defense of his way of life. Though nothing new, homosexuality is having an upsurge since the war. Whether it is an actual increase or merely an increased public acceptance is a point to be argued. The Mattachine Society, an organization for homosexuals, claims that one male out of six is homosexual. Homosexuals no longer hide in shadows, giving secret signals of recognition to each other. But rather they have joined together into groups or clubs in an attempt to seek freedom and acceptability for their type of sexual inclination. They can be found in all walks of life and on any street in this lonely world, forever searching for whatever it is that drives them on.
And the final piece comes from a various artist CD called Sibilance. Trip Records started the project, and it was intended to be a quarterly queer audio zine. Alas, unfortunately, only two volumes were issued in 1997, but I'm delighted I have them, as one contains this fun piece by Dean Johnson. You may also know him as leader of the bands Velvet Mafia and Dean and the Weenies. Those were rock bands, but this track, uncharacteristically, is spoken word only. It's called Girdle.
I went to Kmart to buy a girdle because they just opened in the East Village and I figured it would be cheap. So they don't have a men's dressing room in the women's lingerie department. So I went into the women's room to change, and some woman comes running in all hysterical. She's like, wait, sir, you can't go in there without a ticket. So I got the ticket, I went into the dressing room, another woman comes running up in a total panic, and she thinks that there's a man in the women's dressing room masturbating on the Jacqueline Smith collection, you know? So she's in a panic, but by then I have my clothes off, so they go get the manager, this very rotund black woman with a shellac hairdo and a gold tooth in the front. She comes at me and says, sir, you cannot be in the women's dressing room. So I leaned over the top, I said, honey, this is the East Village, and I am not the last drag queen who's going to come in here to buy a girdle, okay? So what are you going to do when a sex change comes in here? Are you going to ask them if they've been castrated yet? Well, and if you can't tell if it's a man or a woman, are you going to check packages at the door? What are you going to do? You know, I said, you've got these commercials on TV with these big-ass bull dykes making Kmart look so gay-friendly, you know? And then I come in here, and I can't try on underwear. And I said, you know, transgender people need a supporting feminine environment in which to try on their underwear. And this big black lady with the shellacked hairdo and the gold tooth, she looked up at me and she said, "Honey, you are absolutely right. You take your time in there, let me know what you need. I will talk to the manager about our Christmas supplies." So I bought a girdle. $16.99, I'll see you at Kmart tomorrow.